Welcome to Sleeping Through Class. I'm Brendan Horahoe. Today, we're going to be discussing the French Revolution. I'm joined today by Kevin Viotto and Nicholas Rishkevitz. We're traveling back in time to the year 1789. There's revolutions taking place. The American Revolution, which we had just talked about, was sort of starting to rise up. You saw the British lose this huge shocker of a war to the American colonists in the 1780s. And the French played a vital role during that war. They assisted the Americans with guns, clothing, the Navy led by Marquis de Lafayette. You had this assistance against a monarchy by the French monarchy. And so now, these ideas that King Louis XVI helped support with the revolution against the British, now we're coming back to France, and people were saying, how come we're not free? How come our social structure is not, you know, what it should be? How come we're not all equal? We helped the Americans get these rights. Why don't we have these rights? So, Kevin, can you tell us how French society was structured and some of the issues that it had prior to 1789?
Yeah, so similar to how in the U.S. you might think of a class system where you have the upper, the middle, and the lower class, in France, these are the estates. Now, they're structured a little bit differently. The first estate is the clergy, so think the church, priests, etc. In the second estate, you have nobility, so like the king of France, his relatives, etc. The third estate is everyone else. So in the first estate, they make up about 0.5% of the population, while the nobility, the second estate, makes up about 1.5%, which leaves the third estate clocking in at about 98%. Now, most of the land ownership is going to be extremely disproportionate. The third estate is 98% of the population. They control only 65% of the land. Meanwhile, the church at 0.5% eats up about 10% of land ownership, and the nobility makes up the last 25%. And taxation is incredibly different, with the first and second estates paying none of the taxes, and the third estate, the commoners, paying 100% of the taxes.
Okay, so you have these very unstructured sort of social classes, right? And it really does seem unfair if you stop to look at it from an outsider's point of view. You would think that one third would be the first estate, one third would be the second estate, and one third would be the third estate. But in fact, it's really, really lopsided. It's just really interesting to see how the wealthy and the people who had that position sort of took advantage of the bourgeoisie, you know, of the common Frenchmen. You know, they sort of abused them. And it just seemed like a really bad system. But it had been that way for a long, long, long time. The kings of France had run France like this for centuries. So, Nick, why are things changing now in the 1780s? How are the 1780s different?
Sure. Well, things had been this way for a long time. And even if you look in a lot of other societies, and even up until the modern day, you still see that many societies have this great inequality. Even here in the United States, we have something like the top 1% of people in terms of wealth owning somewhere around, 50% of the nation's wealth. That's, you know, pretty incredible. And that was the situation in France, and it had been for a long time. But a couple of things are going to come together that are going to be sort of the causes for the French Revolution that we're going to talk about. And a little trick that I learned as far as how to remember these is meat, bread. So what does that stand for? Well, the M, that stands for monarchy abuses of power. So while the poorer people of France, the 98% that made up the third estate, paid 100% of their taxes, they also didn't have a great deal of wealth. And you know, for them, in some cases, it was difficult to put food on the table. But the monarchy, the king of France, for example, spent money on fancy entertainment and elaborate dinner parties while the people of France were starving. The queen, Marie Antoinette, famously had a fake village established on the palace grounds at Versailles where she pretended to be a commoner. She would go out and she had basically servants who would play different roles within this little fake village that she had, and she would go out and do things like milk cows and stuff like that. And it was her way of sort of getting a taste of what life was like for the common person, But then you have to remember, for the regular common person, they're starving. And when she's done basically playing for the day, she goes back inside and eats these lavish dinners at these dinner parties with expensive clothing and jewelry. So one of the problems, the M, is monarchy abuses of power. What is the E? The E stands for Enlightenment ideas. So that was something we covered in a previous podcast episode. If you go back and listen to that, you can get your refresher on the Enlightenment ideas. But real quick, those were just kind of new ideas about how society should work, how government should function, the purpose of government, the idea that people have rights, and that they have the right to change a system when it's not working in their favor or it's not working the way it should be. The A stands for American Revolution. So the whole world had watched as these American colonists not only declared independence against their British king, but then fought and won independence. And it kind of spread to other societies, like to the people in the Third Estate of France, and it gave them this idea that it could be possible for them to fight and get independence from their king, who they felt was ruling unjustly as well, or to change their system. The taxes, that would be the taxes on the Third Estate. That's the T, sorry. T is taxes on the Third Estate. So as we mentioned before, the Third Estate, the poorest group, which made up the majority of French people, paid 100% of the taxes, while the wealthy, the people who had money, did not have to pay any taxes. They only benefited from them. And then finally, bread. What is the bread? Well, bread shortages. That would be sort of the result. Another cause of this. Bad harvests and weather in 1787 and 1788 led to shortages in bread. And if we talk about sort of basic economics, people need bread. As it becomes less available to them, the price goes up. There's a higher demand and a lower supply, and that leads to higher food prices, and people who are already struggling to get by are going to struggle even more. And all of that's going to combine to create a lot of anger and a mentality that things in France need to change.
So the tensions in France are rising, and things are starting to become more and more complicated for King Louis XVI. He does something that hasn't been done in over 175 years. He calls for a meeting of the Estates General. And so when he does this, he's basically kind of calling in all representatives of all three of the estates in order to talk about how to fix these things. He's hoping for new laws to possibly get passed. And as he's doing this, he goes and calls for the cahiers, which are like these notebooks that where the French write down their grievances, and they're all sent to the Estates General. And as we get there, we start to realize that what the king wants and what the people want are super, super different. So, Kevin, can you just talk to me a little bit about the expectations for these three groups with the Estates General?
Yeah. So the Estates General, they're gathering together representatives from the first, second, and third estates all together, which, as you alluded to, the last time this was done, we're talking 1789, it was last done in 1614. So been a long time since they were able to do this. So as the French economy is going down the tubes and the people are starving, King Louis XVI, he's tried to figure out a way to help bring France out of this. And naturally, as part of the elite, his idea is to raise taxes. Now, as we alluded to before, who gets taxed in France at this time? 100% of the taxes are to the third estate, who make up 98% of the population and are currently poor and starving. And to contrast that, you could say King Louis XVI looks like he hasn't really missed a meal in quite some time. So that is really upsetting to the French people. So at the Estates General, the king wants each estate to get one vote. So the first estate, which constitutes 0.5%, gets one vote. The second estate, which constitutes 1.5% of the population, gets another vote. And then the third estate, representing 98% of the people, they get a vote. So naturally, the third estate realizes that things are stacked against them. This is unfair. Screw this. We're going to do our own thing. And on June 13th, 1789, the third estate declares themselves a new government, and that's going to be the National Assembly, where they try and do their own thing separate from the king.
So, Nick, the National Assembly is created, right? The third estate goes, and they branch off, and they start to do their own thing. The monarchy doesn't know how to respond at all. So what does the National Assembly want, and how do they try to work inside and outside of the king's government?
Sure. So first off, the National Assembly was not recognized as a government of the people. The king doesn't recognize them at the time. Other nations don't recognize them. But they are basically going to put forth sort of some demands for what they want to see happen. It's important to know, too, that they were not at this point involved in the meeting at Versailles. They actually get locked out because the king basically doesn't want to deal with them, and they instead meet at a tennis court. There they agreed that they would not quit meeting until the king accepted them as the voice of the people, and this is all known as the tennis court oath. Eventually, the National Assembly will write the Declaration of the Rights of Man, which gave basic rights such as liberty, property, and security to the people. And you can kind of see where those ideas come from, right? The right to life and liberty and property. That comes from John Locke. So there's another influence we see of those Enlightenment ideas. You know, if you listen to our podcast on the American Revolution, that John Locke and his ideas from the Enlightenment influenced the American Revolution pretty heavily. He also has a role influencing the French Revolution with his ideas.
So King Louis XVI is in a tricky situation here. He basically has to give in to the National Assembly, and based on the tennis court oath, he gives the ability of each representative to have a vote, but he knows that he is going to lose a massive amount of power. So as things start to heat up, he realizes that the monarchy is being threatened now, because if you're losing political power in the Estates General, if people aren't respecting you, if people are starting to realize that the National Assembly might have more power, he decides to, you know, protect himself and preserve the monarchy with the military. This doesn't really go well. The French celebrate Bastille Day, which is July 14th every year. What happened at the Bastille, and why did it matter, and how did King Louis screw this all up, Kevin?
All right, so, yeah, in America, we always know July 4th, that's our Independence Day, and it's one of the dates that is, you know, it's probably the most important date in American history. In terms of world history, July 14th, 1789, it's on that level. Here, the Bastille, it's a prison, and on that day, the French citizens attack that prison, and they take over, and inside, there's a ton of weapons and gunpowder. So now you have the Third Estate, making up 98% of the population, now armed and extremely dangerous. I think you can see where this is going. So now they're so big that they can fight against the king and his own army. So now, in this chaos, Maximilien Robespierre is the guy who's going to sort of come forth from the French populace, and he's going to be the figurehead of this French Revolution. He and his group, called the Jacobins, they're going to arrest people who support the king or challenge their power. And on September 3rd, 1791, the first written constitution is going to help establish Robespierre's Reign of Terror, as it's going to be called, where in about a year's span, 17,000 people are going to be executed, mostly by guillotine.
So, Kevin, you sort of hinted that, you know, things are going to go really bad with Maximilien Robespierre, and the Reign of Terror sort of gets going. 17,000 people are going to die. Tell us about how bad they went, and what happens with, you know, King Louis XVI and the nobility.
Maximilien Robespierre is going to lead this revolution in which, in about a year's span, 17,000 plus people are going to be killed by guillotine, which comes to quite a few people per day. And it ends up on January 21st, claiming the life of King Louis XVI himself. So the French populace, now armed and extremely dangerous, capture the king and stick his head into a guillotine and cut his head off. Later that year, his wife, Marie Antoinette, will also be executed by guillotine. And actually, one of the fun facts, I guess you could say, of the Jacobins and Robespierre is that they consider themselves sort of like the Committee of Public Safety. And in looking out for the public safety, they killed 17,000 people of their population. So, a bit ironic there. Robespierre actually will be accused of being a tyrant himself. Hard to guess why. He'll be arrested and executed the following day. This sends France into a series of governments that sort of rise and fall, various coups ensue, and this goes until 1799 when a man that we commonly think of as Short comes in and fills that void.
Yeah, Nick, can you tell me about that short little French general who takes over and just give us a sort of a summary of how things go in France after that?
Sure. So, obviously we can see there was a lot of instability following the French Revolution with Robespierre coming into power and the Reign of Terror and all of this killing and destruction in France. The guillotine became such a common sight at the time that it was even actually sort of modified. They would make small ones that children could play with, and they would do, and I know my students are always like kind of shocked by this, but kids would sometimes catch small animals and decapitate them with their toy guillotines. Same thing, another sort of example of that we see is it was used in entertaining. People would sometimes have them a little small guillotine at their dinner parties to slice bread with. So it kind of became a thing in French society, and we have all this sort of chaos and everything, and we now have this void right after Robespierre and his death. So who's going to fill that void? It is Napoleon Bonaparte. He is a French general in the military from Corsica, a French island, and he stages a coup d'etat, basically a takeover of the government by this general Napoleon and his military. So he had been in the military for about a decade before taking over. He now had sort of the power and respect within the military to get them to do this, and he puts himself into power. He declares himself the Emperor of France. So we've gone sort of full circle here from having a king and wanting sort of these democratic ideals, and then the Reign of Terror sort of backfiring with a tyrant, and now we're back to a new guy who declares himself emperor, sort of same idea as a king. He would start to sell off places like the Louisiana Territory and other colonies in the Americas in order to help finance his wars in Europe. He sort of set his goals on conquering all of Europe, and he was fairly successful. He goes through places that we know today, like Germany and like Austria, and he just sort of conquers these places and wins these amazing victories. He was considered to be a tactical genius of his time. But then he makes a mistake, and that mistake is going to be setting his sights on invading Russia. And one of the sort of rules of war is generally don't invade Russia on the ground. And Napoleon does this in 1812. And it ends up being a really, really rough winter. And if you know where Russia is or anything about it, it's a cold place. So this really cold, frigid winter, lots of snow and freezing temperatures. And Napoleon and his troops are not well prepared for that. And as you can imagine, it ends in failure.
Just to give you a little bit of numbers on this, 600,000 troops began when Napoleon led his men on the Russian campaign. 250,000, so a quarter of a million, died in Russia. 94,000 were taken prisoner. 150,000 were wounded or deserted. And only 100,000 survived. So, not successful at all, really.
Not successful at all. It ends up as a complete and total failure for him. Napoleon is forced back with his defeated army and his depleted army, and his power would sort of wane for 2 years. But then he would make a comeback, and he would try to lead the French back into creating this empire that he wanted to control. And that, too, will come to a halt. It will fail at a battle called the Battle of Waterloo. Napoleon is then forced to live in exile in St. Helena, which is in the southern Atlantic. It's very, very isolated there. And this was to make sure that he did not return back to power. And at the age of 51, Napoleon would die.
So this sort of puts a nice little bow on the French Revolution, right? It started out with this king and the system sort of being corrupt. It was this process where it had to sort of become violent, and it had to work its way through. And eventually they got back to the system where they had another tyrant, where, you know, Napoleon Bonaparte was essentially acting like a king, and the French had to keep pushing through, because just like in America, you know, the first, you know, government that they came up with wasn't exactly working right, and they had to keep tweaking it. Thank you for joining us. Our next episode is going to be on the Haitian Revolution, as well as other revolutions across the world during this time period. For Kevin, for Nick, and for myself, thank you for joining us for this episode, and we look forward to seeing you back on Sleeping Through Class.